Hey, I'm Ryan Flaherty, Senior Director of Performance at Nike. I train some of the world's best athletes, like Russell Wilson, Marcus Mariota, and Serena Williams. At Nike, we believe that greatness isn't born, it's trained. Training's more than just a workout. Each episode, we'll bring you conversations with leading experts in what we call the five facets of training: movement, recovery, sleep, nutrition, and mindset. Today, we're focusing on how mindfulness can transform your performance. You're listening to Trained, presented by Nike.
I think everyone assumes that when either of us are working with athletes, it's all about, you know, it's performance and it's focus and it's motivation. But we only have one mind. The mind that we experience at home is the mind that we take onto the court or the field or the track. And the mind that we experience there is the mind that we take home with us. So when we train in mindfulness, it's really not just about one aspect of life.
That's Andy Puddicombe, the co-founder and voice of Headspace, the wildly successful meditation app. Andy has changed the mindfulness industry. Before Headspace, meditation wasn't all that common. But through years of research and experience, Andy has proved to millions of people that mindfulness works. Before we hear from Andy, I want to just quickly tell you about how big a role mindfulness and meditation has come to play in the training I do with top athletes. First of all, the mental side of training is critical. I bring it up with everyone I work with. We have a phrase we like to use: be where your feet are. In other words, keep your mind in the present moment. And that can mean a lot of different things: positive thinking, visualization, and meditation. Different techniques work for different athletes. But you have to be training your mind somehow if you want to achieve top performance. One example: Marcus Mariota, an athlete I've worked with for years. Sports psychology never worked for Marcus. So a year and a half ago, I introduced him to meditation. Now he starts every day with 10 to 20 minutes of guided meditation, and it's become a key part of his game day routine. Prior to kickoff, standing on the sidelines, Marcus does a focus drill he's learned. For 10 seconds, he stares at a fixed point, usually a logo on the ref's shirt. Then he zooms out, taking in the field, the crowd, the noise, and the stadium. Then he focuses back in on that logo on the ref's shirt. Be where your feet are. That short 2-minute drill gets him in the right mental space to play. I do the exact same exercise myself every morning. And that's why I'm so excited to talk to Andy. So let's get to that conversation. My guest today is Andy Puddicombe. Before founding Headspace, Andy trained and eventually was ordained as a Tibetan Buddhist monk. Andy and I sit on the Nike Performance Council together, but we're also friends. We caught up at Andy's recording studio in Venice, and you can probably guess how we started.
So just take a moment and start with your eyes open and just take in the space around you. Just take a couple of big, deep breaths, breathing in through the nose and out through the mouth. And with the next out-breath, just gently closing the eyes. So just moving the mind into the body, just noticing the weight of the body, the contact between the body and the chair or the floor beneath you. Noticing how the body feels right now, a sense of heaviness or lightness, sense of restlessness or stillness. Don't worry too much about thoughts, just allow any thoughts to come and go. And as you pause, just starting to notice the breath as well, that rising and falling sensation. Maybe you feel it in your stomach, your chest, your diaphragm. If you can't feel anything, just gently placing your hand on your stomach. Yeah, nothing really to do, just allow the body to breathe in its own way. Doesn't matter if the breaths are fast or slow. And when the mind races off, when you realize you've been distracted, just gently coming back again. That rising and falling sensation. But right now, today, just coming back to that feeling of contact on the chair or against the floor. Starting to notice the space around you again, the sounds. And when you're ready, just gently opening the eyes again.
Thank you.
No worries.
That's perfect. So I wanted to start with, why meditation? For somebody who doesn't know, why would you recommend meditation?
I'd say, why not meditation? I think we look after so many other aspects of our health. There's an assumption that our mind will be fine. We should look after all the other aspects of health. We should teach kids that that exercise is good and they should eat healthy foods. And we assume that kind of happiness and patience and focus and productivity and all these other things are just going to naturally happen. But we know from our own lives, right, that that's normally not the way it works out. So I think there is just an increasing awareness. I think science has been a huge part of this, especially over the last 10, 15 years, understanding what meditation does to the brain, to the mind. So in the same way as when you go to the gym and you train a muscle and it gets thicker and stronger, it receives more blood flow. When we sit and meditate, certain areas of the brain receive more blood flow. So the cortex thickens, it gets stronger, and that area sees more activity. So qualities like focus, like feelings of happiness, well-being, we tend to experience them more as a direct result from meditating. So it makes a difference. And I think it makes a difference not just to how we feel in everyday life, but also how we perform, how we prepare for performance, how we execute our performance, and how we recover from performance.
Talking about today's view of sports psychology and how majority of athletes today, that's what they're indoctrinated with is Western sports psychology.
Yeah.
Positive thinking, right? And you and I had this conversation a bunch, but in an average NFL game, a really good game, 50 to 60% of the time it works, you know? So you're dealing with just about every other play being negative. And so that tension is always there. So can you talk a little bit to that of kind of the differences between meditation and positive thinking, Western sports psychology?
Yeah, and this really comes down to the nuts and bolts of meditation as well, and sort of the philosophy and the experience of meditation. And first of all, I would say, look, I'm not saying for a moment that positive thinking is a bad thing, but there is a very significant difference between the two. So when we're training in mindfulness through meditation, we're really learning to step back from thoughts and to witness thoughts as they come and go. Positive thoughts arise in the mind, it's okay. We see them, we let them go. Negative thoughts arise in the mind, it's okay. We see them, we let them go. There's no kind of internal dialogue of, oh, that's a bad thought. I shouldn't be thinking that. Or I must keep thinking positive thoughts. All of that energy that would have gone into that is now being put into the game, is being put into that moment of kind of focus. Whereas if we're continually engaged in positive thinking, we're really kind of just engaged in a storyline. So we've created a storyline that we think is going to help us, which is great as long as it lasts.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is when that storyline falls apart. Now, that storyline might be quite strong because we might have experienced a lot of success in the game. And if it is, it'll probably see us through quite a lot of kind of difficulties. But even then, if something happens at a really critical moment, the ability to let go of what's just happened and come back to the storyline of positive thought, that's a really big ask. Rather than relying on this fairly kind of unstable model of having a single storyline narrative in the mind, it's way more powerful to get to a point where you have complete freedom of mind. Like in that there's no fear of a negative thought arising.
It's like that flow state that a lot of athletes talk
about. And so moving towards that flow state, I think, not only helps us to relax into the game, but also obviously kind of helps our performance as well.
Yeah, because I mean, in flow, when you listen to athletes talk after games when they score, you know, Kobe Bryant scores 80 points and they ask him, you know, about this play or that play, they ask him what he was thinking in that moment. He doesn't know. I don't know what I was thinking. I don't really remember it all that clearly,
it.
You know? And I think that's where we talk about a lot with the athletes I work with is, you know, I noticed with them instantly in the conversation we had after you'd met with them was that light bulb moment was not be getting too high with the highs, too low with the lows, but just staying very even. It's neither good nor bad. It just is.
Yep.
So an interception is, it just was, or missed, you know, shot in basketball, just was a missed shot. It's not a negative play or a bad or a good play.
Absolutely.
It just was.
And even more than that, it's already happened. It's gone.
Yeah.
There is nothing we can do to change it. So the ability to be able to kind of to let it go, although, you know, that's often seen as a very sort of passive thing, it can also be very active. In that moment, if we are immediately able to let that go, then we will be more focused in this moment for the next play.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge. Rather than being there kind of still thinking about what just happened or jumping ahead, thinking about how we're going to make up for what just happened, and again, being lost in thought. So the more we can be present, kind of undistracted, the more focused we're going to be.
For people who push back and wonder, if everything is just is, how do you make choice? How do you understand what's good and what's bad, or what's wrong and what's right? How do you kind of balance those two things with having emotion and kind of living everyday life?
We will still experience moments of joy when that, you know, when we do perform at our highest level, and we'll still experience moments of frustration and sadness when we don't. It's just how long we remain caught up in that and how overwhelmed we are by that. So the more we can kind of train in that quality, the more helpful it is. For most elite players, at least, at that level, their skill level is the same. It's habituated, they're trained to it. And the only thing that's preventing them from applying that skill level is their mind. So again, the more we can approach a game with this sort of mentality, the more likely it is that we will make the right decisions at the right time to execute.
Yeah. One of the biggest things I heard from one of the top quarterbacks that I trained is that I'm not good at meditation.
Yeah.
You know, because he had associated all the thoughts that run through his head as, oh, I'm just not good at being absolutely thoughtless, which is humanly impossible. I mean, even the highest ranked Buddhist monks have thought, right?
Of course.
Yeah. So I think the way you explain it, and it allows people to understand that nobody is good at it. It's just a matter of the practice that allows you to work through your mind and allow those thoughts to pass by without, you know, taking them for a ride.
Yeah. That I think that most people think it's about sort of trying to clear the road of thought. If the cars are the thoughts, it's trying to clear the road of cars completely. And actually, that's not really what meditation's about. It's more about sort of sitting on the side of the road, getting comfortable with the traffic passing. And through doing that, by not being engaged in the traffic naturally starts to slow down. And that really sort of changes. All of a sudden, there's no pressure. Like if I asked you right now to just go over to the road and sit there, you wouldn't come back and go, wow, Andy, I really nailed it today. You know, I mean, I really was able to watch the car.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just be kind of like, yeah, I just watched the cars. And to begin with, probably the first day, you'd be a bit distracted. And then after a few days or a few weeks, you'd probably find it much easier to sit on the side of the road and not be distracted. Every now and again, it's Venice right here, so something crazy will happen and someone will go, and that might attract your attention. But even that, after a while, you'll be able to see it, let go of it, and come back to a point of focus.
I think having that to always get you through those times, I think is huge. I think in the biggest moments on the sports stages to the biggest moments in everyday life. So it relates to just about everything. I mean, to everything.
Do you know, and it reminds me of, there's an interesting crossover working with athletes. I think everyone assumes that when either of us are working with athletes, it's all about, you know, it's performance and it's focus and it's motivation. But we only have one mind. The mind that we experience at home is the mind that we take onto the court or the field or the track. And the mind that we experience there is the mind that we take home with us. So when we train in mindfulness, it's really not just about one aspect of life.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that's when I love talking to you, because we have that connection of having worked with some of the top performers in the world in whatever aspect of life it is. And I think that's what people miss all the time, is that it's always about helping them perform, you know, a movement better or get a little bit faster. But really, it's just kind of helping, you know, them work through home life, giving them advice on, you know, when they first come in contact with money and how to deal with that, how that can potentially change you. And it's not just for athletes. It's not just for, you know, monks. It's for everybody on the planet to allow them to handle life. Something I've always wanted to talk to you about.
Yeah.
How do you handle, you know, knowing that you've stood on the shoulders of a lot of teachers, right? You know, meditation is not something you created, right?
That's
but
for
yet
sure.
You're bringing it to the world in a way that the world hasn't seen before. How do you deal with that? And also, too, how have you kind of connected back with some of your teachers, and how have they felt about how big this has all gotten?
Yeah. Well, I've almost stood on the shoulders. I've sat at the feet of many teachers.
Yeah,
and look, I think that there's something actually really liberating about knowing that these techniques have been around for thousands of years. They're not mine. I don't feel any kind of sense of pressure from that point of view. It's not like something I've created and I'm putting out there and I'm hoping it will work. I know that it works.
Mm-hmm.
It's been around for a few thousand years. They've worked it out, you know? So it becomes then more about sort of, okay, how do we create the most compelling invitation to actually try it? And then as we started kind of put this stuff out in the world, I think there was a bit of nervousness. And 10 years kind of later, it is so nice. Like last year, one of the Tibetan lamas, the abbot of the monastery and my retreat master flew in. We invited him
wow.
to a big group kind of retreat day with all the team. He flew in and it was just amazing to kind of watch the team interact with him and for him to kind of, you know, recognize that this is authentic. Yes, it's being delivered in a different way, but the essence is the same. And for me, that was probably one of, if not the most kind of memorable day of the past 10 years. It felt like it had kind of gone full circle. And just to know that those guys kind of really care about what we're doing, that meant a lot.
Absolutely. Maybe taking a step back, I know as a trainer with my background too, I get to, you know, talk to a ton of people who really want to get healthier, want to investigate it, want to read all about it, but yet have such a hard time putting into practice. What's your recommendation as to how people can start meditating, and what's the easiest route in to start?
Okay. There's a few kind of simple things. I think one, it's a motivation, intention thing. So be really clear in your mind. Why am I doing this? Two, find a place for it in the day. Doesn't matter. You might have heard that morning is the time to meditate. You can meditate any time of day. It's just that if you do it in the morning, it is more likely to get done. Coupling it to something else that you already do is a really powerful tool. So let's say every morning, so you have a shower, or every morning you have a cup of tea if you're English, cup of coffee if you're American. In your mind, you're already thinking, okay, shower and meditate. Or coffee and meditate. So all of a sudden, it's become part of an activity that you already do. And anchoring it in that makes it really strong. And it also means you don't have to do it at the same time every day. It's just the same time that you do that activity. The more you can prioritize it, and the more you can, I would say, amplify the idea of benefit. So often we think about meditation of, like, what am I going to get out of it? I think if we come to meditation with, okay, I don't live alone in the world. How can I be the best that I can be for the people around me? And how can I positively influence their life? If we add that to the mix of why should I meditate, all of a sudden that becomes way more powerful than what can I get out of it for myself.
It's a great way to put it. I think when people can have an easier time making a change when they understand how it's going to affect the people around them as opposed to just it for themselves.
Exactly.
You know, something I struggle with that I've always wanted to kind of open up a discussion with you on is I struggle in my role at Nike because we're trying to figure out a problem of how do we help more people move, be healthier,
mm-hmm.
ultimately just make the world a healthier, happier place. That's my mission in life. The struggle is that it's not a problem of not enough workouts out there in the world or not enough diets to follow out there. There's tons of information, right? If anything, there's too much information.
Yeah.
There's something deeper as to why they can't make the behavioral change. There may be something psychological, emotional, trauma. There's something. At the end of the day, I could lead everyone and say, this is based on research. Your doctor's telling you this. You have to change your diet because of these issues. And yet the next day, they're just mainlining sugar. You know, and you're like, well, I just talked to you about this. Can you talk to that? Maybe what your opinion
sure.
is on that?
I think there is nothing worse than forcing somebody into a certain type of behavior, physical or mental. People say to me, oh, you must be telling people to meditate all the time. I would never tell anybody to meditate. I'll talk about the benefits of it and I'll talk about how you can best practice it. You come to it in your own time and you get the benefits out of it kind of depending how you approach it. So I think, look, part of that is storyline. We all have a storyline in our mind and the storyline is normally quite tied to our identity. Who we think we are and how we think about ourselves. And as a result of that, how others project onto us. And that narrative can often be really fixed. So even if someone comes along with a solution that on paper looks way better, the storyline is so fixed. And like, no, that's not who I am. That's not what I do. I'm not going to do that. So it requires a loosening of that storyline. That's where meditation is so useful, because it allows us to sort of step out of that fixed narrative and instead start to see that actually there is no narrative. The thoughts just come and go. And we might have got used, habituated to a certain flow of traffic, but actually everything's kind of moving and changing all the time. And once we realize that, then there's the opportunity, because then we can kind of say, actually, that thought that arises in the morning, no, I don't want to get out of bed and go for a run. That's just a thought. You see it, you let it go, and then go for a run. Like, all of a sudden, the mind is no longer control, thoughts are no longer controlling your life. All of a sudden, like, you have your life back again.
Yeah. I mean, I think when you met with the athletes we started working with, I think when we started with 2 minutes a day for the first week, 2 or 3 minutes, it might have been 3 minutes, but that, they were like, wait, really? 3 minutes? That's still meditation? And I'm like, yeah, 3 minutes. We're doing it for the first week.
Little and often.
Yeah.
You know, people often ask, is it better for me to do 20 minutes at the start of the day or to do 4 or 5 minutes throughout the day? And I would say probably the latter, you know, in terms of developing stability and consistency.
Yeah. So a couple of things I wanted to touch on. For people who struggle understanding how meditation, mindfulness can fit into their current religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. How do you explain to people that it's not tied to
a
religion or spiritual belief, that it can work for everybody?
Absolutely. And I, you know, even just telling my story, oh yeah, I was a Buddhist monk, and people are like, oh, it's not a Buddhist thing. Awareness and compassion, focus, patience, generosity, all the qualities of mind, clarity, they don't belong to any religion. They don't belong to any culture or tradition.
It's human.
And meditation, in essence, is just a skill. Now, the interesting thing for me is how it can be sort of incorporated into one's life. Now, for someone who does have a particular faith, it allows that person to deepen their faith. So it's like a lens through which that faith is experienced, and it's magnified and amplified. Like, that ability to listen to one's intuition or higher power, however kind of one defines it and talks about it, that's a really powerful thing. So, you know, we have always made a great effort to deliver it in a secular way, but in such a way that it can be applied to anyone's life or anyone's faith.
What's the greatest lesson you learned from any of your teachers? The one thing you can remember as something a teacher had taught you that really stands out?
There are two. Can I have two?
Please.
Is that greedy?
Please. No, not at all.
The first is, it was not a throwaway comment. It was something to the effect of, be gentle, be kind, be patient, be present, and everything else will take care of itself. If we can focus on those things, just being more present, then I think a lot of life kind of takes care of itself. The other one, now in Tibetan, this sounds kind of fine. In when it's translated, it for some people is a bit morbid, but it was to keep death by your side. Now, this for me has been one of the most profound things that I ever learned at the monastery. And I think it's really important. I think we blast through life kind of with the assumption that we're going to live forever. And because of that, we don't really kind of appreciate what's going on right now. And also, it provides a very particular lens through which to live life. And when we have that feeling of, wow, very humbling experience, feel quite vulnerable, but also we feel incredibly present in those moments. So that idea of just always having that by one side, not in a morbid way, not thinking about it, but just as an ever-present kind of truth, I guess, in our life.
No, I'm just really glad you're talking about this, because the more that's at top of mind, the more present in your mind, I think the better better person you're going to be, the better life you're going to live, because you're going to take advantage of the time you have to make the most of it and have the biggest impact. So you talked earlier about the stories we kind of tell ourselves. And I know for me personally, I've had, you know, I struggled with kind of, as I started to see success in my life, as to did I deserve that success or not? And what for you was one of the stories that you had to really work through in your life to get to where you are today?
Good question. I think the biggest thing kind of, I guess, longer term has been really just overcoming that fixed sense of being a particular type of person. As long as we think of ourselves as a particular type of person, we have limited ourselves by definition, because we're using words and ideas to contextualize like who and what we are. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like we put a box around ourselves. As we begin to kind of untangle that stuff and to let go of that stuff, the box becomes a little bit bigger, and maybe over time there's not a box anymore, and all of a sudden our potential is limitless. And I really kind of feel we were always taught that in the monastery, not in an ambitious way, think big, but almost in a existential way, sort of, yeah. think big, you know, like the mind is limitless. Our potential is limitless. Our opportunity is limitless. If we can find a way of tapping into that, and we do that not by trying to find it or trying to create it, more the flip side of the coin, by letting go of the other stuff that who we think we are, or
the
who we think we
were, labels,
yeah, the identity, yeah. Stuff, the more we kind of let go of that, the more we get to experience the limitless nature of mind.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, this has been an incredible experience for me, and I know that everyone listening is going to get so much out of it.
Thanks for coming in.
Of course, man. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
That was such a great conversation, and I've been wanting to have that conversation with him for a very long time, and so I know everyone's going to get a lot out of it. One of the things that I feel like I wanted to mention was just that, you know, I really believe meditation to be something that weaves throughout our lives in a way that very few other things do. Our mind is involved in everything we do, right? So whether it's the work we're doing, our art, for musicians, if we're athletes, if we're business people, our mind's utilized in all of those things, and it's the way we process information. It's the way we deal with, you know, external factors and variables that go on in our life. If you're not, as an athlete, you know, emotionally, physically, financially, spiritually, mentally right, ultimately your performance is going to be impacted by that. Meditation is such an amazing tool because it weaves all of those things together. Unlike sleep or training or recovery or nutrition, meditation kind of sews all of those together in a way that I think allows you to A, perform at your best, but B, which is most important, be a better human being. And I think through this conversation, I think what you'll start to understand is, yes, it's used in amazing ways with elite athletes, but it's ultimately just trying to get people to deal with their surroundings and challenges and adversities better, be more resilient, but also just to be more empathetic and to be happier and to be better humans. Trained is produced by Nike Training Club Pro, the best of Nike, exclusively for trainers. To apply, go to nike.com/NTCPro. Our next episode is with Brett Kirby, a scientist with the Nike Sports Research Lab and the lead physiologist on Nike's project Breaking 2. See you then.
Consult your doctor before engaging in an exercise program of any kind, especially if you have a medical condition. Use good judgment and common sense about your own fitness level and ability when engaging in a training program. If something doesn't feel right, stop immediately and seek medical attention as necessary.